This is Scenic Roots, talking writing. Our guests are Elliot Ackerman and James Stavridis, the authors of a new novel titled 2034, in which they posit the possibility of a nuclear war between China and the United States. Elliot Ackerman is the author of several novels, most recently Red Dress in Black and White. His books have been nominated for the National Book Award, the Andrew Carnegie Medal in both fiction and nonfiction, and the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, among others. He's both a former White House fellow and a Marine who served 5 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, where he received the Silver Star, the Bronze Star for Valor, and the Purple Heart. Admiral James Stavridis is retired from the U.S. Navy, having spent more than 30 years rising to the rank of 4-star admiral. He was the supreme Allied commander at NATO, and he previously commanded the U.S. Southern Command, overseeing military operations in Latin America. At sea, he commanded a Navy destroyer, a destroyer squadron, and an aircraft carrier battle group in combat. He holds a PhD from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, where he recently served 5 years as dean. He has published 9 previous books and hundreds of articles. He's also a frequent national and international television commentator, as well as a Bloomberg Opinion weekly columnist and a monthly columnist for Time magazine. At the beginning of the novel, it's March 12, 2034, U.S. Navy Commodore Sarah Hunt is on the bridge of her flagship, the guided missile destroyer USS John Paul Jones, conducting a routine freedom of navigation patrol in the South China Sea when her ship detects an unflagged trawler in clear distress, with smoke billowing from its bridge. On that same day, U.S. Marine aviator Major Chris Wedge Mitchell is flying an F-35E Lightning over the Strait of Hormuz, testing a new stealth technology as he flies dangerously close to Iranian airspace. By the end of that day, Wedge is an Iranian prisoner, and Sarah Hunt's destroyer is at the bottom of the sea, sunk by the Chinese Navy. Iran and China have clearly coordinated their moves, which involve the use of powerful new forms of cyber weaponry that render U.S. ships and planes effectively defenseless. In a single day, America's faith in its military's strategic preeminence is in tatters, and the potential for nuclear conflict between the U.S. and China is no longer the stuff of nightmares, but is an imminent reality. I'd like to start by asking you, you are both extremely accomplished people. You have both been published widely. Is this the first time you have written together?
This is my 10th book, but my first novel, and the way the collaboration came about, and yes, it is the first time Elliot and I have collaborated on an piece of literature together, but we've known each other close to a decade because we're both graduates of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, where I was the dean, and I asked Elliot to become our writer in residence after he published his first novel, Green on Blue, about Afghanistan. So we've known each other close to a decade. We share our graduate school experience at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and he is by far the more accomplished novelist. I learned a lot working with him, and it was a real pleasure to collaborate with him.
What do you find is the essential difference between telling a story that is, while it's informed by fact, is fictional, as opposed to writing a piece that is informed by fact and is not fictional?
I loved writing a novel because all my previous 9 books were nonfiction and were, very fact-based, very footnoted, full of references. It's like wearing a straitjacket when you write nonfiction. But when you're writing fiction, you know, you throw off the straitjacket and you can splash a little paint around, so to speak. I like the idea of bringing characters into a story. You know, I could have written a policy book about the dangers of a war with China, but a lot fewer people would have read it. It wouldn't have had any characters in it. And you can't really project into the future in a very definitive way, the way you can in a novel like this.
Well, I have to compliment you both on the characters. They are etched in my imagination. They are very much three-dimensional, whether it's the pilot Wedge, the admiral, the female admiral who smokes a cigar with one of the other, I think the other woman is an admiral also, on the deck of the destroyer. Here they are comparing how good one Cuban cigar is over another. It was an interesting insight into the culture, I assume, that you have both experienced. Is that true, Elliot? You have been a Marine. Are there female Marines?
There most certainly are female Marines, and I think although Jim and I come from different services, we are both serve as naval officers, so there is overlap. And I think particularly with the characters who are Marines or Admiral Sarah Hunt, who you mentioned, you know, we very much wanted to make sure they were steeped in the cultures from which they came. But then there are also cultures we were engaging with these characters who are much farther afield than our own. You know, for instance, Qasem Farshad, who is a brigadier general in the Iranian Quds Force, who spent much of his career fighting in the shadow wars against the United States in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, and also fighting in Syria, or even Admiral Lin Bao, who, when we first meet him, is the Chinese admiral who is the military attaché to the United States. So, you know, throughout this, as you create these characters, you know, both of us were drawing from our own experience base, our own knowledge base, but then at the end of the day, also your imagination and what you. Your vision of the story, as you mentioned, that you know, that cigar, or there's a scene with some M&Ms very early on with Lin Bao, so that the reader can really feel the story and it becomes tangible to them.
It strikes me that all of the principal characters are, in one way or another, you mentioned the Iranian. I think that he probably have a lot of common ground with Wedge, who is an American, a pilot, from a family that goes back four generations of flyers. Their attitude to the world and their place in it, there seems to be a lot of commonalities.
Sure, I would definitely agree with that. And sometimes at face value, you might think that a fourth generation American Marine fighter pilot and a at least second generation Iranian officer, you know, couldn't be more diametrically at odds with one another. But obviously, the commonality they have is, you know, they come from these military families. They're individuals who've been defined by conflict. So in many ways, they are, in fact, very, very close to one another. And I think often, you know, in a novel, as you create these characters, you know, you're looking for areas of overlap. You know, the books that I enjoy reading, which are the books that, you know, I also aspire to write, are the types of books where there'll be a character that I will become deeply emotionally invested in, who at face value would seem to have no areas, you know, where I would have an access point to that character, but that the author is able to show me those areas where we are similar and where we have so much in common, and in so doing, really, really surprise.
Yeah, I'd like to compliment you both on creating fully fleshed out three-dimensional characters. I can see those people when I'm reading what they say. It's almost as if their accent is there on the page in my ear, which is really mixing metaphors, sorry. But I'd like to address a question to both of you. At some point toward the end of the novel, you say America is a quote-unquote idea. Do you think all of the players in this war were countries that in the minds of the combatants, so we're talking America, China, Russia, and Iran, in the minds of the combatants representing those four different countries, are the countries an idea in their mind too?
After you, Elliot. One of the things that makes America unique from many, many other countries is that we are not a blood and soil nation, meaning that what defines America, you know, is not an ethnicity, and it isn't even necessarily the boundaries, the geographic boundaries of our country. That many, many number of the people who came here immigrated here, and of those, they came here for an idea, for that American idea. So, for instance, I could go immigrate to China, but as long as I'm alive, I will never be Chinese. Whereas a person from China could come to the United States, and as soon as they take that oath of citizenship, they are American. Now, have we always perfectly executed that idea? Have we always lived up to the ideals of this nation? No, of course we haven't. But this nation was founded in order to form a more perfect union. It doesn't mean that we make the perfect union. We're constantly striving to form a more perfect union. And that's what an ideal is. An ideal is neither true nor false. An ideal is a mark on the wall that we're all trying to reach.
Jim?
I agree with Elliot's assessment. And the only thing I would add to it is that our value system, I think, is actually fairly clear. It's democracy, liberty, two different things, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of education, freedom of assembly, gender equality, racial equality. We execute those values imperfectly, but I think they define us as a nation, and the degree to which America is successful in this century, in my view, will be the degree to which we hew to those values.
While at the same time, the U.S., at least my impression of the U.S. in the book, is a bit like a five-year-old with a machine gun. Well-meaning, naive, not entirely aware of the impact of their strength and their position in the world, which is challenged by a superpower that, just listening to the news today, there's a suggestion that the Chinese might well at some point become aggressors in a war against the United States. After what we've just said about the U.S., in the book you say of China, no one person is ever more than, quote, a single cog in the vast machinery of the People's Republic. And there's the sense, again and again through the book, that the Chinese play the long game, that what might seem to us to be a long time to them is merely a nanosecond in the history of the world and the history of their, I don't know how to describe it. It's not really, it doesn't seem to me that, to go back to that idea of America being an idea, it seems in many ways that China is also an idea, a very different idea, but an idea.
Yeah, I think the challenge is that, in my view, China is gradually changing its self-view from what has been the norm for thousands of years, which was the idea of the Middle Kingdom, that they were positioned between heaven and earth, and they didn't, as a result, feel the urgency or the need to conquer. China has not been one to go well beyond its borders. Today in China, you're seeing the rise of nationalism inside China. You're seeing a much more assertive China in terms of operations globally. They have a global strategy called One Belt, One Road, which is mercantile, geoeconomic, geopolitical. They are moving out. That is a change, and it is going to create friction points with a globally engaged United States of America. So in the book, 2034, A Novel of the Next World War, we're trying to lay out the dangers of those friction points turning into a full-blown Cold War in which there are skirmishes, such as we opened the book with, and skirmishes can lead to battles, which happens in the book, and battles can lead to wars. And as I always say, there's no good guys and bad guys in this novel. There's a villain. The villain is war itself. And if we want to avoid a war in 2034, we better figure out how to approach China and how to work with them. And we better also be prepared in case that fails.
I agree with you, Jim, on that assessment. It doesn't feel as if there's a bad guy exactly, although I must say that the Chinese come across as rather coldly calculating. I thought it was kind of interesting that the ultimate referee, if you will, in the ultimate conflict is India.
Elliot.
Do you see India as having the potential to be able to play a role like that, to be a mediator in a conflict between two huge nations? Not that India isn't a huge nation, but in fact, both India and China are bigger than the United States by far, aren't they, in terms of population?
I think what we see is that India has a young population, a growing population, although militarily at this moment it's not necessarily a peer competitor of the United States or China. I think it's worth reflecting on the fact that in 1939, the United States was the 19th largest military in the world. Our military was right behind that of Portugal, and we sure figured out a way to play catch up pretty quickly. So the role of India is certainly central to the book and how events in 2034 take shape, but that intersects with one of the key themes in the book, which is this idea that if you look at the last 100 years, which I think we could certainly characterize as an American century, that century was birthed really in two European conflagrations, right? The First and the Second World War. And those were two wars that the United States did not start, but the United States certainly finished those wars to great advantage. So 2034, the book opens and the United States and China have started a war. But obviously one of the questions the book deals with is who finishes that war, on what terms, and how do they benefit?
Yeah, my impression is that the whole thing starts because the Chinese are smarting at the idea that America seems to feel that it has free license to travel in waters that they consider territorial waters. So they deliberately pick a fight. And the sobering part of the way they pick a fight is a reflection on how much we are dependent on technology.
It certainly is. And it's also, I think, a reflection on one of the fundamental attributes of war. They pick a fight, but it's a miscalculation because the fight they think they can keep is limited to stopping one of these freedom navigation patrols in the South China Sea. And it quickly escalates through miscalculations on the parts of both sides. But technology plays a central role in this, particularly cyber, because one of the miscalculations is an American presumption that our advantage in terms of conventional arms, aircraft carriers, advanced fighter technology still exists. And cyber really becomes a leveler in the book and takes our advantage and really puts us in a peer level fight because we don't have the same advantage that we think we believe because the Chinese have been able to disable so much of our technological capacity through cyber.
And what led you to that scenario? What do you see the potential for that?
Yes, I think it is a unfortunately realistic scenario. We can still avoid it. You know, this is the 10 to 15 year future. But if we don't rationally confront the fact that we could drift into a war with China, it becomes more likely that we actually will. So that was a real premise in writing the book, 2034.
Yes, I understand that in the scenario in the book, America is the innocent party, at least in the immediate, looking to offer a helping hand, and that hand is swiftly bitten by an enemy that has set them up. At a point toward the end of the book, you quote Abraham Lincoln, who begins in the quote by saying that America will never be defeated, and goes on to say, if destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be it. Author and its finisher, as a nation of free men, we must live through all time or die by suicide. That quote resonates directly because of the plot in the book, and I don't want to reveal the story, but suffice to say that that quote is very resonant in the events in the book. The notion that, let me direct this to Elliot, Jim, that goes back to that, as you were saying before, that idea of America. That in Lincoln's understanding of it 150 odd years ago, America is an invincible power that will never be colonized by an invader. And yet, in the scenario you present, that's a possibility.
And I think what Lincoln was speaking to, you know, he spoke those words several years before the American Civil War, was that oftentimes we imagine the existential threat being external to us. And obviously, 2034 is a book about a war with China that spreads into a global conflagration. But it's also a book about America, and it's about how America responds to that and some of the trends inside America that make us susceptible to not being able to unite and confront an external threat. And one of those is obviously the dysfunction and the hyper-partisanship that exists in our politics today. And that very much plays a role in the book. For example, in 2034, in that world we've created, you know, the president of the United States is both a woman, which seems unremarkable to imagine in the year 2034, but maybe more remarkably and more plausibly, though, too, is the idea, or very plausibly, is that she's a political independent and that our two-party system has become so dysfunctional that she has been able to run and win as an independent. And I think as much as this book is obviously very much a sounding a warning bell about external threats to the United States, obviously China, it's also sounding a warning bell about the nature of political dysfunction that exists in this country and how that if we can't figure out how to solve those problems at home, we will certainly struggle to unite against an external threat.
I think the notion of a nonpartisan president makes perfect sense. I think in some sense, that's what Joe Biden aspires to be. And to some degree, I guess, so did Barack Obama. Barack Obama, as we all know, didn't succeed. It still remains to be seen whether Joe Biden is going to be able to pull this off. He reminds me in some ways of Lyndon Johnson, a consummate politician, but one who also has his eyes on the prize that will benefit the majority. The divide in the book, it would seem, is perhaps personified by Weizcarver, who is the worst kind of hawk. even when he's offered the opportunity to diffuse things, he ignores it because he's wanting to be bellicose and be combative. Given your experience in government, both of you, Jim, if you care to answer this, do you think that that is the true partisan divide between those who would gleefully prosecute a war and those who would do all they can to avoid it?
Certainly, historically, that has been a divide. Look at the war in Vietnam. Look at World War I. There were multiple voices who counseled against going into that war. Look at World War II. The United States got into World War II because we were attacked by the Japanese Empire, and then Germany declared war on us. So there is a rich tradition in the American body politic of disagreement about whether to go into wars or not. My sense of President Biden is that he is less inclined to reach for the military interest, military tool, more inclined to use diplomacy, economics, strategic communication, cultural connection, development, all of those other tools of American power. But I'll observe that those tools, which are sometimes called soft power, to have soft power but not have the means to apply hard power when you need it, is no power. And I don't think we want to be there either.
That's an interesting point. The way you're describing America sounds a lot like India in the book.
I think that's a fair comparison, although India is a very different in so many different ways than the United States. But that is a point that India, by the time of this novel and out into this century, I think will have evolved in a number of ways that are going to surprise us.
In the book, you have effectively two bellicose superpowers. The United States, if you will, gets its nose tweaked by the Chinese. And still, there is the sense on the part of many that this is not a time to step up, but rather to step back and diffuse the situation, not approach it mano a mano, while at the same time, there are those who would do just that. It seems to me that one of the theses in the book is that that is the problem, that America is too quick to take offense and to flex muscles when that's not going to solve the problem. You need the muscle, as you said, to back up that soft approach, but the soft approach is always going to be the only answer that's really viable and won't result in the horror of a nuclear war.
I think the book is very much about the dangers of entering into an escalatory cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, wars are fought by people, and human beings are emotional creatures. And they look back through history, you cannot underestimate the significant role that emotion and miscalculation play in the prosecution of a war. So, you know, as I said, miscalculation is baked into every war because both sides obviously believe that they're going to win or at least finish the conflict on advantageous terms. And because both sides believe that, one side is obviously incorrect because one side is going to lose. That is the type of scenario we wanted to show. So, yes, that certainly occurs on behalf of the United States and also occurs on behalf of the Chinese because, you know, we're all humans here and all of us are subject to the type of folly that often leads to massive wars.
Well, I have to tell you, toward the end of the book, Slim Pickens came to mind in Dr. Strangelove. Given your experience, both of you, from what you were just saying, Elliot, are these decisions not made dispassionately? Is it your experience that emotion plays a part in decision-making at the highest level of government here in America?
I'll answer briefly, but I'd also really like to turn that over to Jim. But I would say certainly emotion plays a role at the very highest levels of government. And I think that our history definitely bears that out.
Jim, is that your experience, Jim?
Yes. And I've done 6 tours of duty in the Pentagon. I've worked in and around the National Security Council staff. I've worked at State Department. It is always true that human nature plays a significant and an often disproportionate impact in driving events. And therefore, we should never underestimate the chances of miscalculation. You know, I'm fond of quoting that great book of leadership, The Godfather by Mario Puzo, in which the Don says, don't make the mistake of hating your enemies. It clouds your judgment. I think that's very true, not only among the mafioso in New York in the 1960s, but among nations today.
You called your book 2034. 2034 is uncomfortably close. That's less than 15 years away. What would your advice, both of you, be to the leadership of the United States for the next 2 decades?
I think my advice for the national leadership of the United States in dealing with China is, number one, have a plan. Create a strategic plan that uses all the tools of national power collectively and doesn't over-rely on the military plan. Number two, a key element in that strategy should be binding together our allies, partners, and friends, especially in Asia, Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, Vietnam, and many others, but also our NATO and European allies. Bring them together with us, not so we can fight China together, but so we can create a balance in the international system. And third, put more focus on technology at the military level, because the best way to avoid a war is to be prepared to fight one effectively. That causes your enemies to stop and think before they launch an attack. That means more investments in cyber, space, hypersonic cruise missiles, nanotechnology, and the like. And fourth and finally, my key advice would be take a lesson from China and try and think more long-term about all of these challenges. China does that very effectively. We are the victims of a lot of short-range tactical thinking. See paragraph one about having a plan. That plan ought to look out over the 50-year, the 100-year future with China.
Thank you so much for your time, Jim. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for the book.
My pleasure talking to you, Richard. I'll let you wrap up with Elliot. All the best. Bye.
Elliot?
Thank you, Richard. You know, I don't have anything to add to what Jim said. I think that's probably a good way to summarize it.
I'm inclined to summarize, at least in part. It seems to me that what he's suggesting, at least in part, is a sort of 21st century version of the nuclear standoff.
Yeah, and I think we just need to continue to invest in these capabilities and to do the hard work of imagining how disastrous any type of direct confrontation with China would be so that we can avoid it.
So you can approach a volatile situation gently by using strength.
Yes.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you too, Elliot. Thank you so much for the book. To be honest with you, I can't say I entirely enjoyed reading it, because I found the whole premise a little frightening, because it seems so possible and so simple. But the fact that you've put it in print maybe has diffused that notion.
Well, I hope so.
Was that your intent?
It was, yes.
Albert Einstein is often quoted as saying, "I know not with what weapons World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones." After reading this novel, you may well have a renewed appreciation for that insight. The novel, by our guests Elliot Ackerman and James Stavridis, titled 2034, has just been released. On listener-supported public radio, this is Scenic Roots, talking writing.